Chapter 14. It must be remembered that the description I have just given of the Swift One is not the description that would have been given by Big Tooth, my other self of my dreams, my prehistoric ancestor. It is by the medium of my dreams that I, the modern man, look through the eyes of Big Tooth and see. And so it is with much that I narrate of the events of that far-off time. There is a duality about my impressions that is too confusing to inflict upon my readers. I shall merely pause here in my narrative to indicate this duality, this perplexing mixing of personality. It is I, the modern, who look back across the centuries and weigh and analyze the emotions and motives of Big Tooth, my other self. He did not bother to weigh and analyze. He was simplicity itself. He just lived events, without ever pondering why he lived them in his particular, and often erratic way. As I, my real self, grew older, I entered more and more into the substance of my dreams. One may dream, and even in the midst of the dream, be aware that he is dreaming, and if the dream be bad, comfort himself with the thought that it is only a dream. This is a common experience with all of us. And so it was that I, the modern, often entered into my dreaming, and in the consequent strange dual personality was both actor and spectator. And right often have I, the modern, been perturbed and vexed by the foolishness, illogic, obtuseness, and general all-around stupendous stupidity of myself, the primitive. And one thing more, before I end this digression. Have you ever dreamed that you dreamed? Dogs dream, horses dream, all animals dream. In Big Tooth's day the half-men dreamed, and when the dreams were bad they howled in their sleep. Now I, the modern, have lain down with Big Tooth, and dreamed his dreams. This is getting almost beyond the grip of the intellect, I know, but I do know that I have done this thing. And let me tell you, that the flying and crawling dreams of Big Tooth were as vivid to him as the falling through space dream is to you. For Big Tooth also had another self, and when he slept that other self dreamed back into the past, back to the winged reptiles and the clash and the onset of dragons, and beyond that to the scurrying, rodent-like life of the tiny mammals, and far remoter still, to the shore slime of the primeval sea. I cannot, I dare not say more. It is all too vague, and complicated and awful. I can only hint of those vast and terrific vistas through which I have peered hazily at the progression of life, not upward from the ape to man, but upward from the worm. And now to return to my tale. I, Big Tooth, knew not the Swift One as a creature of finer facial and bodily symmetry, with long-lashed eyes and a bridge to her nose, and down-opening nostrils that made toward beauty. I knew her only as the mild-eyed young female who made soft sounds, and did not fight. I liked to play with her, I knew not why, to seek food in her company, and to go bird-nesting with her. And I must confess she taught me things about tree climbing. She was very wise, very strong, and no clinging skirts impeded her movements. It was about this time that a slight defection arose on the part of Lop Ear. He got into the habit of wandering off in the direction of the tree where my mother lived. He had taken a liking to my vicious sister, and the Chatterer had come to tolerate him. Also, there were several other young people, progeny of the monogamic couples, that lived in the neighborhood, and Lop Ear played with these young people. I could never get the Swift One to join with them. Whenever I visited them, she dropped behind and disappeared. I remember once making a strong effort to persuade her. But she cast backward, anxious glances, then retreated, calling to me from a tree. So it was that I did not make a practice of accompanying Lop Ear when he went to visit his new friends. The Swift One and I were good comrades, but, try as I would, I could never find her tree shelter. Undoubtedly, had nothing happened, we would have soon mated, for our liking was mutual, but the something did happen. One morning, the Swift One not having put in an appearance, Lop Ear and I were down at the mouth of the slough playing on the logs. We had scarcely got out on the water when we were startled by a roar of rage. It was Red Eye. He was crouching on the edge of the timber jam and glowering his hatred at us. We were badly frightened, for here was no narrow-mouthed cave for refuge. But the 20 feet of water that intervened gave us temporary safety, and we plucked up courage. Red Eye stood up erect and began beating his hairy chest with his fist. Our two logs were side by side, and we sat on them and laughed at him. At first our laughter was half-hearted, tinged with fear, but as we became convinced of his impotence we waxed uproarious. He raged and raged at us, and ground his teeth in helpless fury. And in our fancied security we mocked and mocked him. We were ever short-sighted, we folk. Red Eye abruptly ceased his breast beating and tooth grinding, and ran across the timber jam to the shore. And just as abruptly our merriment gave way to consternation. It was not Red Eye's way to forego revenge so easily. We waited in fear and trembling for whatever was to happen. It never struck us to paddle away. He came back with great leaps across the jam, one huge hand filled with round, water-washed pebbles. I am glad that he was unable to find larger missiles, say stones weighing 2 or 3 pounds, for we were no more than a score of feet away, and he surely would have killed us. As it was, we were in no small danger. Zip! A tiny pebble whirred past with the force almost of a bullet. Lop-Ear and I began paddling frantically. Whiz zip bang! Lop-Ear screamed with sudden anguish. The pebble had struck him between the shoulders. Then I got one and yelled. The only thing that saved us was the exhausting of Red Eye's ammunition. He dashed back to the gravel bed for more, while Lop-Ear and I paddled away. Gradually we drew out of range, though Red Eye continued making trips for more ammunition, and the pebbles continued to whiz about us. Out in the center of the slough there was a slight current, and in our excitement we failed to notice that it was drifting us into the river. We paddled, and Red Eye kept as close as he could to us by following along the shore. Then he discovered larger rocks. Such ammunition increased his range. One fragment, fully 5 pounds in weight, crashed on the log alongside of me, and such was its impact that it drove a score of splinters, like fiery needles, into my leg. Had it struck me, it would have killed me. And then the river current caught us. So wildly were we paddling that Red Eye was the first to notice it, and our first warning was his yell of triumph. Where the edge of the current struck the slough water was a series of eddies or small whirlpools. These caught our clumsy logs and whirled them end for end, back and forth and around. We quit paddling and devoted our whole energy to holding the logs together alongside each other. In the meanwhile, Red Eye continued to bombard us, the rock fragments falling about us, splashing water on us, and menacing our lives. At the same time he gloated over us, wildly and vociferously. It happened that there was a sharp turn in the river at the point where the slough entered, and the whole main current of the river was deflected to the other bank. And toward that bank, which was the north bank, we drifted rapidly, at the same time going downstream. This quickly took us out of range of Red Eye, and the last we saw of him was far out on a point of land, where he was jumping up and down, and chanting a paean of victory. Beyond holding the two logs together, Lop-Ear and I did nothing. We were resigned to our fate, and we remained resigned until we aroused to the fact that we were drifting along the north shore not 100 feet away. We began to paddle for it. Here the main force of the current was flung back toward the south shore, and the result of our paddling was that we crossed the current where it was swiftest and narrowest. Before we were aware, we were out of it, and in a quiet eddy. Our logs drifted slowly, and at last grounded gently on the bank. Lop-Ear and I crept ashore. The logs drifted on out of the eddy, and swept away down the stream. We looked at each other, but we did not laugh. We were in a strange land, and it did not enter our minds that we could return to our own land in the same manner that we had come. We had learned how to cross a river, though we did not know it. And this was something that no one else of the folk had ever done. We were the first of the folk to set foot on the north bank of the river, and, for that matter, I believe the last. That they would have done so in the time to come is undoubted. But the migration of the fire people, and the consequent migration of the survivors of the folk, set back our evolution for centuries. Indeed, there is no telling how disastrous was to be the outcome of the fire people's migration. Personally, I am prone to believe that it brought about the destruction of the folk, that we, a branch of lower life budding toward the human, were nipped short off and perished down by the roaring surf, where the river entered the sea. Of course, in such an eventuality, I remain to be accounted for, but I outrun my story, and such accounting will be made before I am done. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.